Thank you for joining us at this panel. My name is Holly Light. I am the regional administrator for New York and New Jersey at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And in that role, I've been there since January of 2014, and in that role have spent a lot of time on the recovery from Superstorm Sandy, and was actually asked to take that role by prior Secretary Donovan, mostly to have someone on the ground helping to work with folks like Stephen and Dan on our recovery allocation here in the region. So I have had the pleasure of working with some of the folks on this panel in that role, and I think we'll have an interesting conversation today. I'll introduce the panelists in a few minutes, but actually we're going to start with an overview of some of the preliminary thoughts and conclusions and recommendations that the RRPA has on this topic from the work on their fourth regional plan. And Rob Freudenberg will start us off with that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Holly. Can everyone hear me?
No.
No? Okay. Okay. So thank you all for being here. My name is Rob Freudenberg. I'm Director for Energy and Environment at Regional Plan Association. As Holly said, it's our role as RPA staff here today to kind of present the idea, the proposal that we're thinking of putting in our fourth regional plan around certain topics, and then we have an esteemed panel to respond to those. So I really thank you all for being here, and we want your weigh-in and feedback in the Q&A session as well. So I'm going to talk today about our proposal for how we deal with essentially flood zone policy. I like to start this presentation typically sometimes by polling the audience, sometimes just by asking people to consider where this picture might be and when. I know a number of people often think that this is a picture from Sandy. It is not a picture from Sandy. This is Broad Channel, Queens, in February of this year, about 24 hours after a nor'easter. But still, Broad Channel experiences flooding, maybe not quite to this degree, on a monthly basis. This is to say that this is not just about Sandy. What we're talking about is sea level rise and the kind of devastating storms that come. As a way to say that we're going to have to start dealing with these issues in a more comprehensive way as we go forward. So I'm going to overview today some of the challenges that our region faces and then how our fourth plan is looking to approach them and then have this panel weigh in on that. Put simply, too many of our communities are at risk. This is some research that we did recently where we mapped the entire wetlands for the region from the 1850s and then looked at where those wetlands have been developed. We have developed in the places that are now at greatest risk. We developed in the floodplains and the wetlands and along the shorelines of our region, and we have a lot of people living there. Today, we estimate, as if you heard Tom's opening remarks, that there's about a million-plus residents that live in areas that are prone to flooding. An additional 1 million people will be at risk simply because of sea level rise and an increased storm surge. And one-third of those, it's important to note, are socially vulnerable. We've developed, with partnership with Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, an exposure index that really kind of modeled after the Army Corps of Engineers work, where we look at the physical exposure, things like population, job density, the social exposure, those who are socially vulnerable, and the environmental assets, to really get a sense of where is the greatest concentration of things like that at risk. And then we will add the flood layer on top of that to really figure out what we can do, but also look at other issues around resiliency, like urban heat island. Beyond, like I was saying in the beginning, beyond kind of the catastrophic storms, we've done research that shows that with 3 feet of sea level rise, which is increasingly likely in the coming decades, 160,000 plus residents live in places that will be permanently flooded with 3 feet of sea level rise. This is something, where it's likely decades off, but it's the kind of decisions that we need to start planning for today. The planning that we do today is really laying out how we're going to be for the next 30, 40, 50 years, and we have to factor in sea level rise. 6 feet of sea level rise, which we'll see by the end of the century, most likely would put 700,000 residents at risk of permanent flooding. Another challenge that we face is that there are no comprehensive set of guidelines, and federal funding in many ways does incentivize risky development. Given the daunting challenges we face there, there's a need for comprehensive guidelines. This is a picture from Seabright, New Jersey, and it kind of demonstrates the difference in, reaction to storms. You can see the different levels of homes. They're all being raised. They're all elevated. But they're elevated at different levels. So I think number 19 there on the left is probably going to be flooded by a less storm than the homes down the line. And this kind of speaks to the need for consistency of approaches. There is a federal minimum, but I think very few places are going beyond those federal minimums. There's also the issue of how we map flood risk. It doesn't necessarily reflect the climate change impacts, sea level rise, and the more increased storms. These models look more to the past than they do to kind of the changes that are upon us. This is a map that demonstrates the red areas on this map are areas that flooded that are not within FEMA's 100-year floodplain. Kind of a signal saying that things are changing and we may need to change how we do these maps, which drive policy and making decisions around insurance. Another issue is that climate change needs to be addressed at a regional scale. You could say water doesn't know boundaries, and towns, building a seawall that end at their municipal boundary may not be the best idea in general. So there have been programs that have taken a regional approach. I think Rebuild by Design incorporated a regional approach into laying out what they were doing, but I think we need to find ways to ensure that implementation happens regionally as well. And then the idea of funding, the greatest amount of funding for resilience in our region has really come from disaster recovery, which kind of locks us into a cycle of needing a disaster to become more resilient. And there is never going to be enough federal funding to adapt our entire region. And I think the question is, how can we ensure that the idea of resilience or protection is something that we're able to tap into year-round and not just after a disaster? So facing these challenges, we are putting forth a number of recommendations aligned under three different areas, essentially regionalizing governance in the floodplain, reforming the federal flooding and disaster recovery programs, and promoting local adaptation. And just to get into a little of the specifics before we hand it over to the panel, the first idea, and perhaps maybe the most complicated and controversial in some ways, is can we start governing our floodplain in ways that we govern things like our drinking water supply areas or special areas like the Meadowlands Commission? Our region has an excellent track record of doing regional growth management. The Meadowlands Commission has been around since the 60s and has evolved into a growth management program. Our drinking water supply areas, the Pinelands and the Pine Barrens and the Highlands, all have growth management in place that ensure that development and growth happens in ways that is respective of the natural asset there. Our floodplain, if you look at the 100-year floodplain, is similar in size to a couple of those areas up there. Is it time that we start to manage growth in the floodplain as we do in these drinking water supply areas? Maybe putting limits on the areas that are at greatest risk, ensuring design standards that happen within those. And does it make sense to do this at a regional level or perhaps at a state level where there's kind of collaboration and guidance going on from a central location? Similarly, and perhaps maybe this is the role of this commission does, we need to start focusing on risk reduction. There is a national earthquake hazards reduction program that happens for all of our areas at risk of earthquakes. It was set up by the federal government. It pools resources. It brings research institutions together to really focus on ways to minimize the risk of earthquakes. It is likely that flooding and other climate change impacts will require this level of investment and coordination as well. So we're looking at ways to model an earthquake hazards reduction program at the national level in our country. But knowing that in action at the national level is tough, we say let's pilot it at our regional level, perhaps as the implementation body of this commission. Now, to get any municipality or partners to engage in this effort, there needs to be the funding to make these adaptation projects happen. We need to break this cycle of federal disaster funding our resilience projects. So perhaps we engage the private sector. One idea, this is just one idea, is to develop a resilience trust fund funded in a number of ways. And one thing that we just did a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation to consider for the panel today is, what if we put a surcharge, a 1% surcharge on property and casualty premiums, that's all premiums in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. If you were to do that, that would generate $1 billion a year that could go into a trust fund and fund projects ranging from local adaptation, urban heat island mitigation, all the way up to buyouts and restoration, and if we need one in the future, a regional surge barrier. This is the idea, is that we start building this bank today and start funding projects at the local level and regional level so that we can get a head start of this and not rely on the next disaster. Federal programs have improved greatly over the years in terms of adapting to risk, but there's still a long way to go. We are encouraging the federal government to move faster and more strongly in the direction that they've been heading. We need to complete and exceed the reforms of the National Flood Insurance Program, incorporate climate change into the mapping work that's done, expand buyout programs, make them available year-round, and continue the work of the Army Corps to consider the multiple benefits of their projects. And I think if they all kind of took into account the cost benefits that really weighed the costs that come from environmental benefits, I think that would be excellent as well. And finally, at the local level, the idea is that our local areas, particularly those prone to sea level rise, are going to need to tackle this issue, as we mentioned. So we're proposing that growth be shifted away from the most at-risk places. Those areas that are behind them, that require are flooding more periodically, should require high standards of resilience. And finally, we need to incentivize resilience at the local level through planning and implementation resources. Again, there's only so much funding to go around. Every community needs to adapt, and we need to have the resources there. So that is what we're proposing in the plan. There's more details to be figured out in all of them, but we're putting that on the table for the panel to discuss.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Rob. So now we are going to turn to our panel. I will introduce him, starting on my right, Jonathan Goldstick. Jonathan has over 30 years of experience in engineering and managing waterfront projects. He's the vice president of CH2M and has worked on the design and construction and installation of storm protection structures, including after Sandy, he worked on the replacement of the Rockaway Boardwalk, storm surge barriers at the Gowanus Canal and Newtown Creek, and was also involved in the RBD, I assume, the East Side Coastal Resiliency Project that was awarded through Rebuild by Design, the international design competition that HUD sponsored. Next to Jonathan is Megan Lincoln. Dr. Lincoln is a natural hazards expert at Swiss Re. She is primarily responsible for risk analysis and structuring of public-private transactions that protect public entities against losses incurred due to natural catastrophes. Prior to that, she has worked as a weather derivative underwriter, a catastrophe bond analyst, and an atmospheric perils expert. Those are just three super cool titles. I don't even know what they mean, but excellent. Okay, and here we have stepping in for Mayor Zimmer, her municipal manager, Stephen Marks. He's been with the city of Hoboken for 4 years, and prior to that, spent a number of years working for Hudson County in New Jersey. Next to Stephen, we have Carter Strickland. Carter is vice president and program manager for water and natural resources at HDR Engineering. I'm not sure if this is even on your thing, but you were during Superstorm Sandy the commissioner for DEP, is that right, for New York City. And Carter has been active in New York and New Jersey environmental communities for over 20 years, representing groups as a lawyer through the Attorney General's Office and Rutgers Environmental Law Clinic in a wide variety of matters. And then next to Carter is Dan Zarilli, who right now is the Senior Director for Climate Policy and Programs for Mayor de Blasio. He oversees the Mayor's Office of Recovery and Resiliency, and under Mayor Bloomberg, oversaw the Special Initiative for Rebuilding and Resiliency, which was really the plan that sort of hatched the recovery from Superstorm Sandy for New York. He holds an MS in Civil Environmental Engineering from MIT and lives on Staten Island. So climate change is real for your community. All right, so we clearly have plenty of experts from both governmental, engineering, science, and insurance to delve into some of these topics. So I think what we're going to start is I'm going to pose a number of questions rather than sort of everyone presenting their perspective to dig into some of the recommendations that Rob presented. And I'm going to start with a question, and you all can sort of, I'll leave it to you who wants to define it. But just to set the context, we talk a lot, particularly in the realm of resilience, about regional planning. And what do we really mean by regional when we're talking about resilience planning? Does anyone sort of, as you're doing your work, how do you think of a regional definition for this?
Sheer size of it in some ways, but we obviously existed within a larger construct. The experience that we've had from Sandy, 44 lives lost, $19 billion in damages and lost economic activity just to the city alone, wider impacts across the entire region, really showed us the vulnerabilities that we face. And this is not a threat out into the future, 100 years from now. It's not a threat far away. It's a threat here and now, and drove us towards thinking about the types of investments that are needed to manage that risk now. And it's not just one big thing that you can do. It's multi-layered in our mind, that it's certainly investments in our neighborhoods, it's investments on our coastline, our buildings, and as well as our infrastructure. That's the sort of a multi-layered approach that we've been pursuing. At the same time, we're also working to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, which are, I think, very critical to this conversation. But as we think about regional, not everything, so certain things have a regional component, and maybe I have a few examples of that, the clear understanding of our supply chains, and the one that maybe is worth talking about is everyone had the experience of being in the gas lines that existed after Hurricane Sandy, a look at our liquid fuel supply chains. There's a certain infrastructure that is clearly regional, that is from a city perspective, a lot of that infrastructure that serves New York City comes from outside of the city. The assets are outside of the city. We ultimately work to pull together the different levels of government and the public and private actors that are operative in that area to think about some of those solutions, and that work has been moving forward. There's a lot like that. Our transportation system is very regional. If you think, and the way the city and the mayor's One NYC program is thinking about the challenges we face both in housing and jobs and climate impacts as well, there's been more and more thinking regionally about our place in the region. The city doesn't succeed unless the region succeeds, and very much vice versa. I think it was described to me yesterday by the former mayor of Bridgeport that when New York City gets the sniffles, that Bridgeport gets pneumonia. And I think we all need to recognize that we all have that place in the city and in the region. And as a city, we are a bit of an anchor in that. In a resilience context, I think it's important to think about what those things are. And in some ways, I'm a little skeptical of a regional resilience commission, only because of the types of things that we've seen since Hurricane Sandy. Additional layers of government are not necessarily the answer. Smart government, and I think that's the kinds of things we've seen from Holly and her team at HUD in helping clear the path so that we can make the right investments in New York City. And I know she's been doing the same thing, and the Rebuild by Design programs have been allowing more of that work to happen closer to the ground. Has been very important to us. And so I think maybe just one last word on this. As we think about what the future holds for this, we need collaboration. We need collaboration both across borders. We need to recognize, and as a city, we're not always the best at this, we need to recognize that the region does extend beyond the borders of New York City. We also need that collaboration between the levels of government. But we haven't necessarily seen another layer, another commission. It's felt like a bit of a solution in search of a problem rather than the reaction to the problem. And so I think, from our point of view, we want to continue the collaboration that's out there. I think the substance of the rest of the recommendations, limiting certain amounts of growth in the floodplain, building better, zoning code improvements, the kinds of things that the city's pursuing through its own actions, very right on target. And certainly no one's going to argue.
You're a little skeptical about the commission concept.
I'm I'm a little skeptical about the commission concept, largely because the city has been doing a lot of good things, and we've found the ways to collaborate and partner, and with that has been not necessarily another level of things that are needed.
So other thoughts on this commission. Who would have to be included in something like this to make it effective, and what types of authorities might it have to make a difference?
Holly, I think it depends in part on what level of protection we're looking at. There's a number of things underway right now. Well, first of all, I think there's the reality that the more broader the net is, to answer your first question, the greater the certainty of funding is, right? It's better to have 6 senators or 8 possibly than 2. So that said, in terms of project delivery, there's the funding piece and then there's the project delivery piece and the standard setting piece. I think those are important functions that don't have to happen at the same place. Right now, there's a lot of big seeming projects, but in the scheme of things, they're very small if you look at international examples. They'll be very protective, but I think at the end of the day, and if it happens in 5 or 10 years, as we learn more, there's going to be a harbor-wide solution, for example, or you're going to need the federal government involved, the federal government, at least in terms of structures that have happened to date, you're going to need a local partner. It's going to have to be there to deliver a small piece of funding, whether it's 10% or 25% or 35% that can work. So I think it's going to have to be perhaps harbor-wide.
So Dan sort of spoke to this sense that these communications and coordination are sort of happening, and maybe we don't need another layer, but Dan's also New York City, which is sort of the 500-pound gorilla in the room. Stephen, do you feel like something like a regional commission that kind of created and forced this coordination at a regional level for a smaller city like Hoboken, would that have benefit?
I agree with Dan in that a new layer of government, I don't think, is the answer. If we're talking about something that's by state, we already have the Port Authority. There's a reaction now to kind of pull back some of the authority from the Port Authority. If we're not talking about a bi-state solution, if we're talking about truly regional organizations, New Jersey has the NJTPA, North Jersey Transportation Planning Authority, DVRPC, Delaware Valley Regional Planning Authority, and South Jersey Transportation Planning Authority. Those three organizations are MPOs. They're Metropolitan Planning Organizations. They already have authority to do planning on the regional level for transportation. They are also looking at hazard mitigation with regard to its intersection with transportation investments and transportation infrastructure. And I think, at least for New Jersey, I can't speak for New York, but at least for New Jersey, I think those three MPOs would be kind of the ideal regional players to do hazard mitigation and disaster recovery, disaster preparedness.
So it sounds like maybe if we hadn't had Sandy, something like this commission might have been useful, but we've all sort of worked through figuring out how to coordinate through the various agencies that exist and commissions that exist and just relationship building. So maybe there's not as much of a need if we just sort of continue to formalize some of the relationships that we've already had. Is that kind of the...
I think maybe partly responding to Carter's point around, the types of, like, if there's a harbor solution, if we're talking, in this construct, I think we're saying resilience equals flood protection. I think probably most people would nod their heads and say that's not the entire definition. But at least in this flood protection context, if there's a regional solution that is, the barrier that's proposed to connect Sandy Hook and the Rockaways, if that, I think for a lot of reasons, that may not be the right answer. If, say, that turns out to be the right answer, that's probably the one big thing that needs the big regional harbor-wide solution. For lots of reasons. We're across the state, you've got all the impacts, the shipping, the river getting out, all the things that make that complicated make that probably a wider conversation that's necessary. In the absence of that one solution, I don't know that there is a regional flood protection program. Right? I think RBD, Rebuild by Design, highlighted this very well, that targeted improvements in with a knowledge of the region, but targeted investments in places like Hoboken, in places like Lower Manhattan, and what we're doing in Hunts Point, and other targeted neighborhoods, and the other investments that are being made across the region, end up not needing that same level of, you know, one big local sponsor to play that role. And so that's, I think, in the absence of that big solution, you may not need that big organization. I think that's a...
Jonathan, let me turn to you on that. What, in terms of planning for resilience, how would you view that? What would you say the framework for that is, and how does it differ than, say, transit planning or other regional planning?
The biggest difference, we've come across this in looking at the regional plan, the biggest difference is really the scale of the planning in terms of size, but also the timeline. Because the solutions should be informed by what we want to do going forward. And if we're talking about long-term sea level rise, and every month you get a different report on what that will be and when it will come and what the magnitude is, the region may have to look like a very different place. The base plate of New York City might have to be 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 feet higher. And if you can look forward and say, in 150 years, we want to look a particular way, then you have a master plan. You can say, this project that I'm contemplating doing, does it fit into that larger plan? Instead, the individual projects are going ahead in many ways absent that master plan. And that gets into the regional planning again. And I think we've lost the scent a bit by talking about this commission as another layer of government. I think if we took a poll here, it'd be something to zero about whether we need another layer of government. the fact is, we might just have it wrong. So if you look at the places that have done things regionally in a big way, they're places that have very few layers of government. It's the Netherlands, it's the UK, it's Singapore, it's Russia. Now, there are other things wrong with those governments. But they can do large scale. They can do large scale planning. So when we're working in the UK and we look at implications of sea level rise in the UK, we're looking at the entire coastline of the UK. We're not looking at just London. So it's looking on a very large scale what's going to happen and a very long timeline. So everyone agrees on what we will look like. So we all know if we're getting here.
Interesting. One thing on this planning concept that I'm very interested in, Stephen and I are waiting with bated breath on some modeling. I'm curious what the panel thinks about the technology of modeling for future storm events and for climate change. Are we at a place, as we're pouring lots of money into resilience infrastructure projects, where we can really rely on that technology to know that if we do X, Y, and Z in Hoboken, that's going to do PDQ to Jersey City? I mean, where are we in that technology as we're sitting here investing lots of money and trusting these models to inform where we're doing those investments?
Well, I hope you never guarantee a certainty, and I don't think anybody will at this level. But you look at the historical rainfall record, right, or storm level, and I would agree, we're talking just for purpose of conversation about storm surge and Sandy type scenario. There's a lot of elements to resiliency. But the historical record is not an accurate prediction of where we're going to go. I think it's pretty well understood. Modeling's the best tool we have. It's not perfect. I will say it will get better over time, so there's got to be an iterative sense of adaptive management and building on what we think is now the best information we have, but leaving ourselves open. And I think that's what one thing that's encouraging is, I call this the first wave of Sandy investment or resiliency investment. There's going to be others. Last night, Bob Bureau said that since in the last 20 years or so, I think the number is, MTA's come up with like $75 billion investment in that system. You know, we know I see some DEP people here. You know, over the last 10 years, New York City DEP, the agency I used to run, just for New York City's water, wastewater, invested $20 billion. So you get talking in terms of multiple billions. New York City has $20 billion of the $60 billion. This is going to be a first wave of investment in resiliency. So let's invest what we have now wisely and then we'll know more when the next wave comes.
Yeah, if I could echo even a on top of that, it's the uncertainty that's built into the projections is also important. And you know, we have an organization called the New York City Panel on Climate Change that gives us forward-looking projections, and there's uncertainty built into those projections that needs to be understood and grappled with. And to your point, it's the things we're doing now is the start of the conversation. We're vulnerable now, and so we need to move quickly. But we need to do it in an adaptive way so that the investments we make now are not precluding future decisions that may be different or more difficult that need to be made based on whether the level of sea level rise or other projections that we're seeing. But that we don't paralyze ourselves thinking the city has to look like this in the year 2150, and therefore we have to do one big thing or lots of really big things, when in reality we can do more smaller things now, things we can afford that don't preclude that future option. So it's really an adaptive pathway, and it's not like the $20 billion is not going to be the last of the spending for sure in New York City on climate resilience.
I would say in the modeling too, it's sort of a two-part answer. We're great at modeling. If we know what the inputs are, we can come up with very accurate models. Mm-hmm. The reason we're getting these models all over the place is we can't agree on what the inputs are. How fast are the ice caps melting? What will future temperature be? So everyone gets the same answers, and they really do work if your assumptions are right. And that's a $64,000 question.
So let's turn to the question of a trust fund for a minute. I am gratified that no one believes that this is all going to happen because of the federal government, since I feel like I spend a lot of my time reporting in that Congress really is as dysfunctional as the newspapers report. So we can't all sit around hoping that everyone believes in climate change and writes blank checks for resilience. So with that, I think thinking about where this funding is going to come from is important. You know, Dan talked to how proactive the city has been in starting to invest and commit funds to doing smaller scale projects over time that will have a cumulative effect. The Rob spoke about the potential of a surcharge on casualty and homeowners insurance as sort of a pilot in this region. Megan, you may be the best position to comment on whether you think that that would be a viable model and what might be the process for effectuating that.
So first, I don't work for a primary insurance company who issues individual homeowners policies. I work for a reinsurance company, so we take the portfolio risk from the primary insurers. And I will say that it's potentially a viable idea. You know, I don't think anybody's going to know if it's going to work until it's tested in the market and see how the actual purchasers of the policies respond to such a proposal. But I think it highlights something. I think the concept highlights another very important idea, which is that at the moment, we do know that flood rates for the NFIP are artificially suppressed. And when you artificially suppress your flood rates, you're going to incentivize development in high-risk areas, and that's going to continue. A couple months ago, I was in New Orleans attending the annual meeting of the American Meteorological Society, big focus on Katrina because it was the 10-year anniversary, and I was actually able to listen to Craig Fugate speak. And one of the takeaways from his talk was that we really can't build with the hope of insuring. You need to build with the concept of insurability in mind. And when you do that, you'll be developing structures that are far more resilient because you will disincentivize high-risk development. And I think that really has to be the focus. People need to understand that when they purchase a home, what true risk they're taking on from flooding. And not only that risk today. I'm in the process of purchasing my first home now, and I'm taking a 30-year mortgage. So I don't only need to think about what are my risks today in May 2016, but what are my risks throughout that whole 30-year period? And if you're living in a 100-year flood zone, yes, in any given year, your chance of being flooded is theoretically 1%. But over the term of that mortgage, that increases tremendously to 30%. And I think that's how we have to frame the conversation around development, insurance premiums, flood resiliency, to have a paradigm shift to help the population think in that framework.
So does that, if you play that out, are we essentially saying that our coasts are only going to become a place where wealthy people can live?
my family actually has a house on the Jersey Shore, and I understand that, you know, that these communities are very deeply ingrained in our culture here, and it's not as simple as saying, okay, we have to relocate entire communities, because I think emotionally that's very difficult for people to kind of wrap their heads around, and we saw that in New Orleans, and we've seen that firsthand here with Sandy. But I think what we should do is not continue to develop our coasts. If areas are currently wild, continue to let them be wild. Don't bulldoze them and put houses there. Let the natural barriers that are in place to protect us from these extreme weather events remain there and do their job.
So I do want to get to the idea of retreat versus protect in a minute, but on the Resilience Trust Fund, does anyone have any other reactions to the surcharge before we kind of leave that idea, or have any other ideas about how a trust fund might get funded?
One question I have to Rob was that whether those numbers were statewide.
Yeah. So those numbers.
We were surprised, Dan and I were surprised to see New Jersey higher than New York. But I guess, you know, if it is going to be statewide, you know, I would think that part of resilience then, like a lot of other infrastructure programs, has to be spreading the benefits or making clear that the benefits are broad. I mean, it's hard enough in New York, we know, to make the case in Albany that, you know, it's a good thing to have that so much of the revenue comes from New York City, right? So it'll play into that upstate, downstate tension, if that's the way it's structured.
That's a good point. And just so you know, those numbers were statewide, and the idea is that it would not just be for flooding resilience, it would be for all forms of resilience,
right,
so that the benefits are shared throughout.
So some of the other ideas that we've looked at for funding resilience, and I can't say that we have come up with any great answers at this point, but one is the concept of kind of playing off of catastrophe bonds. Could there be something like resilience bonds? Is that a viable potential, you think?
There is great opportunity for the public sector to work with the reinsurance and the insurance industry to increase their financial resiliency, especially in the wake of a natural disaster. If we look at 2015, approximately 70% of the losses from natural disasters and man-made disasters globally were not covered by insurance. And if you have these events that are not covered by the private insurance market, that's going to fall onto the backs of the government. And ultimately, it's going to fall onto the backs of the taxpayers, because you're going to have to raise revenue to address this disaster recovery. And this post-disaster funding approach is just not sustainable. And resilience is not really relying on the federal government to come in. Look how long it took to get the Sandy funds appropriated from Congress. And, I mean, that's still 4 years. We're still in the process of recovery. So the insurance industry has worked with all over the world with public entities to enhance their financial resilience through insurance policies. And one of the most successful is the CRIF, which is formerly known as the Caribbean Catastrophe Risk and Insurance Facility. And the CRIF pools together 16 governments in the Caribbean and allows each government to buy an insurance policy to protect themselves against earthquake, tropical cyclone, and now excess rainfall. The heavy rainfall product was just rolled out in 2014. And so the individual countries buy the insurance policies from the CRIF, and then the CRIF turns around and reinsures their whole portfolio in the private insurance market. And this allows these countries to tap into their insurance policies when an extreme event happens. And a great example of that in 2010 was the Haiti earthquake. Haiti had purchased an earthquake insurance policy from the CRIF. The 2010 earthquake exhausted the limit on that insurance policy, and Haiti got a payout of almost $8 million approximately 2 weeks after the event, and that allowed them to continue to fund their police force. There was no waiting for money from the government. There was no waiting for even money from donors, which I know eventually poured in. They had that $8 million right when they needed it, and they were able to continue to fund a part of their government functioning.
So how would that look in the realm of resilience? What would we need to know or better understand that might potentially get something in the insurance industry to be willing to cut rates or create some kind of funding that would help fund resilience infrastructure today for the protections that it would have down the road?
You know, I think that that conversation is starting, but it's still very early on. And I will say that it is something, you know, the insurance industry has been, particularly Swiss Re, we've known about climate change for over 20, 30 years. This is not exactly a huge surprise to us. So it is something that the industry is thinking about, and we're starting to kind of move in the direction of seeing how we can couple our products offerings with resiliency infrastructure to, you know, work together. But I would say it's very much in its infancy, and right now it's very conceptual.
Yeah, Holly.
Go ahead.
So, no, I wanted to make a point on this, too, because we're talking about resiliency infrastructure. And, you know, the federal dollars that have come in that we're spending, and we're spending on things that you'd probably consider resiliency infrastructure and flood protection and things, it's a huge opportunity to buy down our risk, but we know that's going to go away. So finding other sources is important. But there already are existing sources. I think, and the number I have in my head that we developed during our 1MIC process last year is that there's about, over the next 10 years, there's going to be about $250 billion spent on infrastructure, public, private, across the whole city, and I think that was even some regional investment. We need to make sure that we're building infrastructure with this in mind. It's a lens to put on the things that we're already doing. And so when we're investing in, whether it's, you know, every time we upgrade our streets and our drainage systems, we need to be doing it with an eye towards climate risk, low carbon development. I don't think we'll ever succeed if we need to find money for resiliency projects. We need to make resiliency part of how we do projects. And there's lots of other lenses that get applied to projects, of course, but this has to be one of them. And we're never going to, like, we could come up with cost estimates for all the things we need to do. We'll never secure all that money. We need to be a little bit more creative on using the dollars we spend to reduce our risk as well.
And how do we do that? Does that come from city codes? Does that come from the federal government?
Yes.
What's the viable way to start doing that? Because let's face it, New York City is thinking about this now, and other parts of the region are, but even here in the Sandy region, memories are short. Mm-hmm. There's already starting to be, we've seen that with residents in Hoboken, there's already starting to be a resistance, and then that doesn't even start to get into how do you convince people who have never seen a disaster that this is a viable thing that they need to be thinking about.
So we've done something in the city, and we're on round two of this, called the Climate Change Adaptation Task Force. We've pulled together 57 different organizations. It's different levels of government. It is public and private infrastructure partners. And the first round of it a couple years ago was looking kind of in silos at the different assets and their vulnerabilities to risk. And that really helped our investments that we're making now with the federal dollars. What we're doing now, and we've kicked this off again, is brought those same players back together and having them look at their risks, also look at the interdependent risks. So it's leading towards design standards. It's leading towards design guidelines that the more people understand their vulnerabilities and understand how their capital plans work, we're going to be investing to reduce those vulnerabilities. And it's happening, you know, there are public entities here, there are private regulated utilities. It's the whole gamut of players here. I think that's the kind of cooperation we need, and it lands on design standards. It needs to be built into building codes, it needs to be built into zoning codes, but it has to be based on that level of analysis of where are our vulnerabilities and how do those vulnerabilities propagate through the network of infrastructure and neighborhoods that we have in the city.
For those of you, maybe this is Carter and Jonathan the most, who work in other parts of the country, other countries, what has been the way to sort of get people to think about this if they haven't encountered a disaster? I mean, are there places being proactive about this even though they haven't experienced anything that's really made it real for them?
Well, one of the things that's often said is that places that have taken action have been hit more than once. So that makes it very real for people. The Netherlands has that story. The UK has that story. The big reaction doesn't come after the first disaster. It comes after the second disaster, and people can no longer say, that was a fluke.
So it may just be a reality that you have to go through it to really start investing it in a meaningful, long-term way.
It's a depressing thought, but that's what we've seen, because you can do only so much public outreach. The same thing happened when gas prices spiked and they came down again. People are back in SUVs. We have a very short memory as a country. So it's the second disaster that does it.
I see one view on this is that, you know, I give a lot of credit to the folks at the Rockefeller Foundation for their 100 Resilient Cities program, and we participate in that program, and the folks that I deal with, work with, collaborate with in New Orleans, you know, the cities that have gone through a disaster approach it differently, but this is a global thing that I'm seeing. There is a conversation developing in those places that haven't had that disaster, but what they typically face is that they don't have that public will yet to make big investments, and until the big thing happens to you, it's like the dollars don't flow and the political will isn't there. But there is more of a groundswell of understanding these risks in advance, trying to make investments where they can, and so it's the conversations are different between the cities that have had an impact versus those that haven't, but there is more awareness now of the what that risk might look like.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, two examples I can point to are where they're getting the planning together, at least. Climate Ready Boston. Boston hit a little bit, you know, side glance by Sandy, and historically a lot of, you know, Northeasters come through there. You know, they're doing the planning. Are they going to make the investments? They're not going to have that kind of money yet, but they and subsidiary towns around there are. Rockefeller, I think, is having a great impact on that. A good friend of ours, former New York City government person, I was just named Chief Resiliency Officer for Chicago. And I think what you're going to see there, my guess, it's purely my guess, is that they're going to put some historical weather-related disasters, like the big heat wave that killed a lot of people there, into a resiliency framework and try to leverage that into at least planning. Probably not the investments yet.
So this feels like it could be a good role maybe for the federal government, because we could come in and sort of require things. Are there thoughts that you all have about how the federal government could be more effective either in the planning perspective or also in the actual, you know, you got, for those of you who are in the weeds on this, in a programmatic way? I could talk about this all day long. But.
I'd love to hear Megan's thought about the stalled flood insurance reforms.
I just think, and that what's gone on with the NFIP is a great example. Is the government has to stop incentivizing risky development, and you know that's a big one. The second that those standards or those artificial requirements fall away, people are not necessarily going to realize how risky it is to build in those areas. And I mean, I just have some statistics that a colleague of mine had pulled up. So since 2005, the U.S. taxpayer has spent over $300 billion on the direct cost from extreme weather and wildfires. And in 2012, the U.S. government spent $96 billion for climate events. And if this was actually a line item on the budget, it would be the largest non-defense discretionary item on the budget. It's more than we spent on transportation and education. And please do correct me if I'm wrong on that one, Holly. These were statistics I got from a colleague of mine. It's the government has to stop incentivizing this risky development. And I think what's been done with Rebuild by Design, and I know that at the state level, Dan, I can't remember, is it Blue... the relocation?
Blue Acres and Green Acres.
Is one Green Acres, one Blue Acres?
Blue Acres in New Jersey.
They're both in New Jersey.
Okay. Yeah. So, but I think that those are also great programs. So this, the steps are being made, but there really does have to be this disincentivation of high-risk development.
So one of the things that FEMA did in Sandy, I believe for the first time, is that it... in addition to its traditional only giving enough funding to rebuild exactly what was there, they created an overlay of a mitigation program so that you, through their regular program, you only got exactly the amount to rebuild, but then you could overlay a mitigation money and actually build in resilience for future projects. I don't think that has happened across the board because the mitigation funding is not as robust as traditional funding, but it is sort of a change that I think they've made in recognition of repetitive loss. Other changes that...
Well, I think I've seen with the federal government adopting flood standards of either, you know, the 100 year plus two or the 500 year or best available science, those have been helpful because they start to establish what that floor is for investment in a floodplain. There's more work that's happening through a couple different interagency things that I have a window into on aligning federal investment strategy around disasters. And yes, the reforms at FEMA have been, I think, really positive on making sure that it's not a dollar for dollar, you replace what was lost, but you can improve it or do something alternative, which is even maybe a better approach of, you know, you can price out the things that would have rebuilt and added mitigation, but you actually think about maybe there's a better way to do this. And I think we've been phenomenally successful as a city in securing nearly $10 billion from FEMA for investments in our public hospitals, public housing, all the civic infrastructure around the city, and taking a hard look at how do we spend those dollars to the best effect and not just limited to, you know, putting back in place the things that were there. We are going to see a major shift in how the city looks because of all these investments, and you know the risk is reducing over time. I think in this conversation of, you know, we shouldn't be incentivizing development, the city's always in a different place in that because the development's already there. And so how do we make investments that reduce risk in a cost-effective way? How do we make sure that as we do new building or new zoning or new looks at the levers we have to pull in municipal government, that we're thinking about this future risk? But the support from the federal government has been great. The funds that have flowed, the standards that have come with it have been, I think, positive. There's more to do, though. I think NFIP is one area where there's something clearly broken that needs to be fixed.
And I think if I could just also add to Dan's point, one of the things that I feel that FEMA, the federal government, whichever term you want to use for it, should do, because we do have communities that are already in high-risk areas, like I said, I have a house in one of them, is start including climate change projections in some of these maps. You know, right now the 100-year floodplain maps are static, and we should start looking at what do we have to plan for going forward, because like Dan said, climate change is not a problem that we're going to need to address down the road. It's here, and it's happening today.
And so one of the other changes that HUD is looking at, as we're talking about potential programmatic improvements, is making disaster recovery funding a standing program as opposed to a required appropriation. Megan spoke to the great delay between Sandy and actually having the appropriation made for the disaster recovery money that came through HUD. Any thoughts about that? Is that putting lipstick on a pig, or is that a good approach to supplement?
One of the biggest problems in that three-month lag between the bill getting passed, you know, FEMA has its direct funding, and so it was out right in the communities telling people, do this, build this certain way, or go to SBA and get a loan. Right. 3 months later, CDBG shows up, and now all that guidance was essentially bad guidance because it was given in a context of not having CDBG there. But in reality, all these programs are putting emergency dollars through programs that are not emergency programs. And so they come with all the red tape. They come with all the requirements that make it get spent a little too slow in some cases. I think that's something that's, you know, that lag, I think, was difficult. And making it more, you know, automatic is probably a tough word. But having those dollars be targeted for very specific emergency outcomes in a consistent way, regardless of whether, you know, a bill gets passed or additional types of dollars show up, would be really helpful.
If the federal government's going to be able to, even out of self-interest, really, reduce its cost by creating a more predictable funding stream, I think that's great for everybody in the infrastructure business. Money's fungible. If it has to be spent on emergency, then the local money is going to be spent on regular stuff. Just, I have similar numbers to Megan in terms of what's been spent since 2002. And there's some Irene and Sandy, and there's some big items in there. But you contrast that to, I know that the clean water world is what I know. Clean water, drinking water funding, maybe $1.5 billion a year in the state revolving fund from the federal government, and wastewater is a little bit more, but in the same range. Small percentage. And so having a greater money that could be spent towards infrastructure is going to be critical, I think, going forward.
Let's talk about retreat for a minute. Dan, you know, you spoke about the complexity in New York City of championing a retreat perspective, and you know, clearly after Sandy, the mantra from the city was, we're not going to retreat. We're going to stay where we are. I had received a phone call, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks after Sandy from Borough President, Staten Island Borough President Otto, who was desperate to get any government official to come in and buy out entire neighborhoods because he was having people come in and ask for that and to use eminent domain to clear out some of the most vulnerable neighborhoods and couldn't get anybody to be willing to take that step. There has been some buyouts between the state and the city in Staten Island, but certainly not to the extent that there have been in New Jersey through the Blue Acre program or through other places. Do you think, in retrospect, maybe, you know, Carter, you were in the city then too, do you think that we would have been wise to do more buyouts and to take a different stance in terms of being more aggressive about that where we could, like places in some parts of Queens and Staten Island?
I think there's a clear reality in that in those moments after a disaster, there are, I mean, the emotions are high, and it's tough to come in and say, in those 2 weeks, we didn't know what the dollars looked like. It's hard to come in and say, we're going to make commitments at those moments. It was 3 months later, it's a year later before funds start to flow. To make those commitments is probably tough at those, because you don't know what resources you have to deal with. At the same time, in those same neighborhoods, and this is a federal question, there's a $580 million Army Corps seawall project being developed in front of those neighborhoods. That sort of complicates the question of where we should be thinking about those types of acquisition programs. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be using land use as a tool for resiliency. And the city has been looking across the entire city around where we can potentially limit vulnerability by limiting density. We are already, the state has been doing its buyout programs in parts of Staten Island. We've been using some federal dollars in a targeted way to make offers to homeowners that are either next to parks or next to DEP drainage blue belts in Staten Island. So there are some targeted ways where it's pretty clear that certain houses shouldn't be rebuilt or in a certain location. To say that that should be the whole east shore of Staten Island, I think, is a much, much harder question, both from the dollars point of view, the unanimity of approach, and having everybody decide that that's what they want to do. Eminent domain has its own fraught challenges for purposes like that. And what we're seeing is that if you don't have 100% of the people that want to participate in that, the city still has to maintain the roads, still has to provide utility service. Somebody has to still drive down and deliver the mail on those streets. If you don't have that 100%, you end up with a much, much worse outcome, I think, in those neighborhoods.
Can I add on what Dan said? I did some back-of-the-envelope calculations, and numbers are daunting. There's my envelope. for buyouts. But I think I'll go through them in a minute, but I think it's useful that number out there, because then it makes some alternatives look reasonable. So just, HUD, the New York Times reported this week that part of HUD's, second round of $1 billion grants includes $48 million to move some folks in Louisiana. But at least as reported by the Times, it was 60 people. So that's about $800,000 per person. So, to applying that to the $160,000 people in the floodplain now that Rob mentioned, it's $1 trillion. And if it's 1 million people, it's $8 trillion. It's a big number. Staten Island, at least the numbers I have, $100 million for 248 properties, buyout program. It's about $400,000 per household, different measure. And in New Jersey, they're reporting $300 million for 1,000 properties, or $300,000 per household. So the numbers are big, but the Staten Island example is an interesting one because there the community kind of wanted to sell out for the most part, and there were some holdouts. So politically, it was easier. But there are alternatives. And right next to that community, Great Kills Harbor, I know DEP has its Oakwood Beach plant. And, there's some horrific stories, during Sandy, those workers were isolated there. It became an island, but it was never inundated. And it's right next door. It was rebuilt in the late 70s, 11 feet higher than it had been. So, again, there's some alternatives that are possible to rebuild these vulnerable communities. Same thing in the Rockaways. The whole Rockaway Peninsula was, overtaken. If you walk there immediately after Sandy, you could see sand that looked like snow because people had shoveled little pathways and a foot or two of sand. Pretty remarkable. But there's some new developments that the city had that were pretty unaffected. So you can, maybe it's a very optimistic view, but you can design your way out through renovation and rebuilding of some vulnerable communities.
And I'm struck by the map behind us and looking at the floodplain. What does that mean in Lower Manhattan, having this context? So it's one thing in a Staten Island context or smaller homes, and what does that mean there? And that's some of the floodplain, and those are some of the residents that we're talking about as well in the floodplain. The answers, I think, are not as simple as we are, you know, abandoning the waterfront.
Right, and Hoboken, similar situation, built right up to the waterfront, more or less. You know, it's interesting. Stephen and I are working on the Rebuild by Design project there, and I alluded a little earlier to kind of this phenomenon that I've been blown away by, but the mayor completely foresaw that it would happen, which is that now that the rubber's hitting the road and we're putting millions of dollars in to do a surge protection project for Hoboken, there's a lot of resistance from residents, even some who went through Sandy, about blocking views, blocking access. What's the right way to balance that? How do you deal with their short-term memories, and what's the perspective where you do have places where retreat feels not viable, and yet you get resistance to what that means?
I think you have to do a cost-benefit analysis, and for a place like Hoboken, we have 50,000 people in one square mile. We're a hub of infrastructure. Within the one square mile, we have $10 billion worth of property tax ratables, and we're a major transit hub for PATH and New Jersey Transit. So I don't think anybody has been talking about retreat from a place like an urban core like Hoboken in New Jersey. But if on the Jersey Shore, once there's a second storm, then I think the state of New Jersey and other local communities along the shore are going to have to really evaluate, you know, do we rebuild or do we, you know, do we let the sea rise? John Englander is a floodplain expert who just addressed the American Planning Association's national conference in Phoenix. And he was saying that we should really be planning in 30-year increments. And by his account, looking into the research, there's about 27 feet of sea level rise contained within the Greenland ice sheets and another 180 feet of potential sea level rise in Antarctica. And, you know, we're doing planning for 3 feet and 6 feet with significant pushback with planning horizons of 2050 and 2100. But really nobody's talking about what's going to, you know, the sea level rise is not going to stop at 2050. It's not going to stop at 2100. And we have to be looking out also with major investments affecting Manhattan and the New Jersey coastline and nationally, you know, what is our coastline going to look like in 2150 or 2200? It's a scary thought, but we have to start thinking about it now.
Megan, if you were made governor of New Jersey or New York 2 days after Sandy, how would you have, what would you have done knowing all you know and your sort of strong feeling about incentives for coastal development? Do you think more eminent domain is a right approach, even though that may be politically sticky?
Yeah, I think it's a very difficult topic to address. I certainly would not want the job of governor of New Jersey or governor of New York. I will leave that to Governors Christie and Cuomo for the time being. But, you know, I have seen firsthand how the Jersey Shore has redeveloped in the wake of Hurricane Sandy. And, I mean, my personal perspective on it is, you know, I would like to see a larger investment in green infrastructure. I would have really pushed for that during the redevelopment, because when you put in gray infrastructure, it's going to be strongest on the first day it goes in. If you put in green infrastructure, if you utilize sand dunes, if you utilize oyster beds and reefs, those are going to flourish over time, and those are going to have a compounding effect the further you go out in the future. So I really wish that had been focused on a little bit more.
Jonathan, you want to be governor?
As it were, if elected, I will not run. I'll run to Mexico or something. It's a hard one. Can I have a stand talking? It's really all about the funding. And the funding is what allows you to do things right away or to think long term. I think long term, a lot of people will have to move out of where they are. I don't know how we get from here to there. And that's really the hard question. I certainly know that if I were governor, I wouldn't tell people who I hoped would vote for me in the next election that they need to leave their homes. So it's a very, very hard thing to do.
Yes.
And that sort of comes back to my original remark about other places with different governments are able to do things like that. It's very hard here where we're into stakeholder outreach, explaining to people why things are happening, and getting that pushback. And the pushback in Hoboken is either very surprising or not surprising at all, depending which lens you look at. Because what we've essentially been telling people, if you step back and look, is you can have everything you want, you can live exactly where you are, we're going to protect you from the water, and it's going to be even nicer than it was before. And now people are saying, looking at a wall isn't necessarily nicer.
So
that's, you said, it's a rubber hitting the road now.
It's one of, I think, the biggest roles that our HUD's regional Sandy team and the DC Sandy team have played is basically to be the bad guy. I mean, I say this to Dan all the time. You can throw HUD under the bus. Everybody does anyway, so you might as well blame us. And it has enabled us. We are very used to, as an agency, being very hands-off and just letting localities and states kind of use our money as they will. But there has been a real role for us in some of the more aggressive positions that the Seder cities have wanted to take, in saying, you know, we have to do something different in Edgemere because HUD says our money depends on it. And I think that's a pretty, that's been a useful role, that's a very unusual role for us to play, but I think has helped give some political cover to your point that, you know, if people are angry at us, that's easier than
you
being
make a
angry
good bad cop.
The mayor or governor, right, great. Well, we have some time for questions from the audience. Right here.
Right. Well, we've done a lot of research with Lincoln Institute of Land Policy on this question. We have a forthcoming report in a few weeks on how to improve buyout programs themselves. So if the tool of retreat is the buyout program, one idea we heard up here is that the funds, you didn't know how many funds were available, so you couldn't really pursue that approach. Having funds available kind of year-round, not just in the context of a disaster, is really important for buyout programs. We're going to encourage that be the case, and perhaps this trust fund is one way you can fund that. I think the other idea is that we need to be working with local leaders. You know, the question about retreat is so personal and down to the homeowner level, and it's really something that has to happen. It requires leadership and guidance from the elected officials. We're working in three communities right now, looking at long-term adaptation is what we're calling it. And it, you know, some mayors get it, and some mayors get the sense that they have to start planning now. So I think the idea around retreat is not talking about moving entire communities. It's more about how over the next 50 years do you start to change your codes and start to improve the planning processes that you have that you can get people on a direction towards, I guess, long-term retreat. I think the thing about retreat that trips people up is it seems so sudden that people need to go immediately. I think if we can start talking about the conversation now, realize what's coming, and have a pathway to get there and the funding to do it, you can start to have that as an easier conversation, not this abrupt change.
I add one point to that, because I think whenever we're talking about the relocations and retreat and those things, we're focused on the places where people are coming from or like where they're leaving. The conversation never really gets to where are they going and what does that mean for those perhaps receiving communities, the density requirements that are necessary there, the infrastructure investments that are necessary to support that. That conversation needs to be, I think, a little bit more comprehensive around the full package of what it means to relocate and use land differently whether it's in the region or beyond, to make that a complete conversation.
What makes the conversation easier for elected officials is that if you have upland areas of town, you can focus your development, your master plans, your redevelopment to keep your tax base in those places. So if it's a longer-term decision, focus on the upland parts of town and build a new tax base there so you don't lose the tax base at the waterfront.
Right.
I would suggest that RPA could look to some larger cities that have dealt with unplanned retreat. I'm thinking about Detroit and Buffalo have very robust buyout programs because they're trying to stop the bleeding. And, you know, I think one cautionary note there is that there's a tipping point. You know, once density drops below something that's livable and, you know, maybe even beneficial to have, you know, instead of density, you know, a park or something, all of a sudden it becomes a little lonely out there. Mm-hmm. People don't live there, but you still have to maintain services. It's very expensive. So there's going to be a tipping point where you're going to want to just have the whole community move, and that is going to be difficult.
That's true.
Here. Nelson Furrier, member of the Regional Plan Association Board. Thinking about the commission concept, when I first heard Rob mention it, I didn't think it was a commission, because the commission suggests political appointees and people who make decisions on the wrong criteria. Maybe a better word is collaboration between the people who are selected for their skills in making the right decisions, for the people who have danced out in other locations around and down the coast, that they are collaborating. And the incentive to do that would be the resources to be able to be proactive and to really respond more efficiently. There seems to be also the concept of systems that are vulnerable. You know, the energy, liquid energy is one, food is another. I mean, our whole supply chain is very much tied up in the first place. And, that's a reason to be, communicating. But communication between the people who are most familiar with the details, the fine grain of decision-making criteria and the technical challenge.
So just to repeat, the comment was that maybe commission isn't quite the right concept because those typically involve political appointees who often don't have either the in-depth knowledge or the right incentives for doing what the goals of this idea were, and that maybe it's better to focus on the collaboration of kind of professional level staff. And I would say that one of the great things that has come out of Sandy, and this is in part because of the president's task force that really focused on how to do disaster better, learning from Katrina particularly, was we are still really actively involved in collaboration efforts, both within the federal family, but also between the city, state, and federal agencies at unprecedented level of involvement at exactly what you're saying, having technical experts working to expedite permitting, working to flag issues early in projects so that they don't get to the point of going for permitting and suddenly realizing that there's some major issue. We're collaborating with among the six largest funders, federal funders, post-Sandy, so Army Corps of Engineers, FEMA, HUD, EPA, Department of Interior, and DOT. We all meet about every month and look at all of our projects in specific geographic areas to make sure that we're in synergy, that we're not in conflict, that timing is coordinated. So I do think we have some models for that kind of collaboration that are going on at different levels. And the question is, can you keep that going when you don't have money to talk about? Because money drives collaboration quite effectively. Right here.
Good question.
But this is a regional problem. It's a significantly large region we're dealing with, very complex, dealing with water. In 1982, Boston had a problem. It was called the greatest polluted harbor in the world. And what we had was a governance problem and a funding problem. At the time, we had an antiquated agency that collected fees and gave it to the legislature. The legislature wanted to build pools and ice skating rinks and not fix the infrastructure. So So I brought a lawsuit, and the goal of that lawsuit was to create Massachusetts Water Resources Authority. The Water Resources Authority represents 51 cities and towns with a governance body, a construction grants mandate, and with a closed financial system that allows it to bond. It integrated all of the projects using, and I believe you need to involve politicians because you're not going to get anything done without them. The question is finding a consensus amongst them. So I believe the commission should evolve from a commission into an agency like the MWRA, linked to the funding of the trust fund, linked to the political advice. The MWRA has advisory board made up of every community leader, but it has a super board of directors that the city has and the state has very significant representation. So I would say on a regional problem like this, you've got to link it to governance. You've got to link it to funding. And that's the only way you're going to have an integrated, planned system for the entire coastline. Planning needs to be linked to governance, and it needs to be linked to funding and to political support.
Just to quickly repeat that, that was a comment that there is a model in Massachusetts that focuses on water authority that actually has successfully found a governance structure to fund these projects, and the comment was that regional governance is necessary to get these funded and to do it in an effective way where it doesn't splinter into pet projects.
Just a very quick follow-up on that. As we talk about more governance or not, it is a shame that the Port Authority did not expand its mission here, and perhaps we would get to a point where it could, because there is such an interplay between the infrastructure and the response. Let's all hope. But there is another structure that does exist currently, and Rob, I don't know if we've looked at it, but it's the Delaware River Basin Commission. You have a compact authority among five states, Delaware to New York. All five governors sit on that compact. It does already have an authority to some degree with respect to water control and water control projects. So without creating new structures, there is a structure that is out there that perhaps might be viable for having some sort of a role here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hi, I'm Arturo Garcia Costa with the National Flood Trust. At several points, the panel sort of referenced the dysfunction of the National Flood Insurance Program, and Rob pointed out particularly it's been bankrupt basically since Katrina. I was just wondering what role you think localities have in influencing reform of that program. The trust has supported Resources of the Future to come up with a new community insurance model that in some way parallels Megan's idea of what happened in the Caribbean, that you have communities actually buy community insurance policies. But I'm interested to know what dialogues you're having with federal officials, whether you're actually working on innovations at the local level.
Yeah, maybe one first point about NFIP is like, yes,
the question, just quickly, the question was about what is going on to help, the localities are doing to help reform NFIP.
What's unfortunate about NFIP is that it was designed to be broke. I mean, it was the private sector pulled out of the flood insurance market, and the feds took it over because it was not making money. It couldn't make money. That was almost this. I mean, this goes back to the 60s, right, when NFIP started. What we've been focused on from a city perspective and advocacy around NFIP is making sure that, one, NFIP accounts for the types of buildings that we have here in New York City, which is a big deal. Right now, it largely doesn't. It's primarily built for as a single-family program. We have a lot of multifamily. We have a lot of other mixed-use buildings that aren't really well accounted for in the program. And so we've been advocating for those sort of changes. We've been advocating for more knowledge around the types of investments that actually reduce risk in those different types of buildings that can also be reflected in the rates and make sure the rates are accurately reflecting those risks. And then we've been also pushing for affordability. And quite honestly, the level of understanding of how those rates are determined in NFIP is just not there. It's driven in ways that's not necessarily actuarial in any way. And so we've been pushing to make sure that the types of things that NFIP does price accounts for the types of building stock we have in New York City, and that as the rates were scheduled to go up 25% a year and 18% a year, it was just going to devastate communities. We wanted to make sure that was, the rates are still going up by all means, and the floodplains are still expanding. but we want a more gradual glide path to allow people the time to make those mitigation investments, the time for these coastal protection investments to be in place so that the affordability doesn't totally wipe out our neighborhoods.
And one of my big messages has been the importance of New York City finding other places that have similarly situated, because New York going to D.C. alone does not work well. So I think this really needs to be expanded into a national perspective on reform in order to really get a serious audience. I think we have time for one more question right here.
So we were talking about the housing and retreat and single family, multi-family. What about all of the buildings, however, in Lower Manhattan, tall buildings that are all owned by private people, private corporations? I mean, really hasn't been a discussion on that. Maybe it's another cool seminar, but maybe it could be touched on.
Yeah.
The quick version, I guess. There's been a lot of private investment at the building scale, and so a lot of the private landlords have been, you know, elevating their mechanical equipment and investing in certain types of deployable flood walls and things. That's great for those assets. We think there's still a more, you know, neighborhood or regional approach that's necessary, which is why we're investing and we put some of our own city dollars on the table to continue to advance some of the concepts that came out of Rebuild by Design to make sure that the if a building doesn't flood, but the whole street is flooded, it doesn't really do anybody any good. So we're investing in coastal protection. The MTA is investing in making sure that the subway system can keep running and is protected. There's been investment on the Con Ed level on the grid that supplies Lower Manhattan, and then the buildings are doing some of their own investments. I think that's a nice multi-layered approach that really is what the city's approach has been all about across the entire city.
Okay, I think we are out of time. I want to thank all the panelists for your thoughtful contributions. And thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Holly.